support for Utah Public Radio comes from the Bridger Folk Music Society, presenting the violin mastery of Scottish fiddler Alistair Frazier and master cellist Natalie Haas, along with the Inish Free Dancers and Leaping Lulu, tonight at 7:30 at the Ellen Eccles Theater.
Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience.
Welcome to Access Utah. I am Sherry Quinn. Joining us on the program is John McCullough, Professor of Anthropology at the University of Utah, and Kathleen Heath, Associate Professor of Anthropology at Indiana State University. For 6 years, they have been sifting through and analyzing over 300,000 genealogical records of America's first settlers. And Dr. McCullough plans to grow the database for years to come.
A couple of weeks before I got to be 65, I looked at my bucket list, and the first thing I had, of course, was a 1958 Testarossa Ferrari. The second thing was a small villa in Tuscany. And the third thing I wanted was a database I could work with and actually get some good articles out on. And that's how the database started.
McCullough and Heath are presenting today some of their research results at a demography seminar on the University of Utah campus in Salt Lake City. McCullough explains the significance of the project.
About 6 years ago, we began to collect demographic data on the descendants of the Mayflower. There is very good genealogical, historical, cultural information concerning this group, and we thought it would be an excellent group to analyze in a demographic way. We wanted to collect information so that we could ask questions such as how women died in childbirth. There are many questions about the rate and the reasons for deaths in childbirth. We wanted to ask questions about migration patterns. We wanted to ask questions about how families work together, how families stay together, how families divide, how families marry back and forth. We have very interesting marriage patterns in this group. And we wanted to analyze those in terms of evolutionary questions. Also, we were interested in intergenerational information because of not only the migration patterns, but also the fact that epigenetics is getting to be a very important part of genetics. Epigenetics is a new area of genetics. We have noted that there are environmental influences that affect not necessarily the structural genes, but genes controlling the structural genes that control such things as the timing of growth patterns. And the occurrences in life of the individuals affect the genes that they pass on to their children, so that if a population has been subjected to starvation, the timing of certain of the genes passed on to the next generation will be affected by this. Or if they have had very good nutrition, that will affect the timing of genes in the next generation as well. And that will be passed on to at least one other generation that we know of.
How did you find the data? What kind of form is the data in that you're looking at?
Most of the information that we have been able to derive comes from genealogical work done by professional genealogists, primarily based in Massachusetts, of course, but also Salt Lake City. A good deal of work has been done on these individuals. The Mayflower group is a very high-profile group in terms of history, in terms of descendants. There are tens of thousands of descendants of the Mayflower living in the United States. So, and actually elsewhere, England, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa. It's a group that has attracted a great deal of interest, not only because they were an early population, but because they were a very important historic population as well.
And can you talk about the study population, how many, and some of the details that have emerged from your analysis?
Well, the study population began with the Mayflower. There were approximately 102 individuals that are counted as so-called migrants in the Mayflower. About half of them died the first winter. We did a very interesting analysis of them. Found that there are two very important patterns that emerged. The first pattern is that if you had relatives, you were probably going to live. If you didn't have relatives, you were probably going to die. The second was that children survived following a very specific pattern, and that is that if at least one parent survived the winter, all of the children lived. If there was no parent that survived the winter, only half the children lived. So that having a parent that survived was very important for children.
What time periods did this analysis cover?
We're really beginning in England in about the year 1550 when the parents or grandparents of the migrants were born and began forming families. And it goes until about 1820 or 1830, but the majority of the information really comes from the earlier years. Now, because there were so few people living in Massachusetts at the time, the sample is fairly small early on. Again, there were only 51 that survived in the first winter, but other people came in subsequent years, not in great numbers at first, to Plymouth. Plymouth was essentially an outback compared to Massachusetts. The main migration to Massachusetts occurred in 1630 when John Winthrop brought his huge fleet of 3,000 people there. And in the following years, literally thousands of people migrated to Boston and spread out from Boston elsewhere. Plymouth Colony remained very small with only a small number of migrants. Part of this was planned in that they would only allow certain individuals to migrate to their towns. The town council had to approve the presence of the individual. If the person was not found to be fit, and usually that was a religious test, then they were not allowed into the town. Or if they had gotten into the town, they were given a so-called warrant of warning out. And they were given 36 hours to 30 days to clear out, or the sheriff would remove them.
So why were they so strict?
Well, they wanted to form uniform communities. This was true not only in Plymouth, but also in Massachusetts Bay Colony. Each town was formed with a contract. The individuals who first got there drew up a list of requirements for individuals coming into the town. These were usually religious requirements, and so everyone in the town was essentially on the same page in terms of religion, and not everybody, even if they were on the same page, was allowed into membership of the church. That sometimes took years, but they could be allowed into town. So each town had its own set of rules. People had to conform to them, and so uniformity and conformity was absolutely crucial in New England in these years. If you did not conform, you were asked to leave. For instance, Roger Conant was a salter. He came to Plymouth to work as a salter. He was kicked out of Plymouth because he did not conform religiously to the tenets of Plymouth. He founded Salem, and within 2 years he was kicked out of Salem because, once again, he did not adhere to the rules of the individuals who became prominent in that town, and eventually ended up in the next town in Beverly. But the town of Salem still has a wonderful statue to Roger Conant and the town commons as its founder, even though he was kicked out.
And what were the major causes of death from first settlement to 1800?
The major causes of death were accidents. It was very difficult to live there. Transportation was difficult. Sea or river transportation was the easiest way to go, and people drowned a lot. Accidents, again, I remember there was one woman who had been married 3 weeks and fell in a well and drowned. Other individuals were struck by a tree while riding a horse. Indian raids were not at first, because the pilgrims got along pretty well with the Indians at first. But as time went on and they became more and more land hungry, they pushed Indians further and further. And finally, the Indians revolted and attacked a number of towns, and a number of people were killed. As a matter of fact, the Indians almost pushed the people of Massachusetts back into the sea and back into England. But in the end, they failed. But they almost did it. And old age was another major cause of death. Kids did not die early on very commonly. Later on, by the time you get to the mid-1700s, when populations build up and towns become more populated, more concentrated, then you get more deaths. But at first, it was an extremely healthy place because there were very few people who lived in that area. And by the time we get to the 1800s, of course, you get major epidemics and scourges coming through that are really tough. But that's outside the realm of our sample.
And your sample shows that maternal mortality was quite high.
Yeah, it was very difficult for women. Every time a woman went into labor, it was a time of great stress. Women did have a very interesting way of giving birth. It was always at home. It was always with a midwife. And ordinarily, they would invite their friends to come and party with them, essentially. They would brew groaning beer. They would bake groaning cakes, as they called them. And the woman would sit around and chat and have a good time while the woman was in labor and giving birth. And so she had essentially a very strong support group at that time. It was only when doctors became more prevalent in the 19th century that the women were kicked out, essentially, and the doctor took over. But in the early years of the colony, women ruled once the woman began her labor. It was a woman's world, period, and the men were there by invitation and only to do errands.
But then when the doctors came into the picture, then their mortality rates skyrocketed, or at least during childbirth.
That's what we think. We think the rates went up. Of course, there are the well-known examples in Europe of the doctors in Vienna who refused to wash their hands. They would go from the autopsy room to examining women without washing hands, and the mortality rates there went up to 25 or 30%. Ignaz Semmelweis tried to stop that in Vienna, and Oliver Wendell Holmes in this country pioneered the thought that doctors should wash their hands and sterilize them with what they had at the time.
That was anthropologist Dr. John McCullough. Kathleen Heath, associate professor of anthropology at Indiana State University, is working with McCullough to compile the data and to help decide which research questions to ask based on the massive amounts of information.
The data that we have is from a founding population. That's rare that people have transgenerational data from a founding population. And really what that means is we have written records of peoples coming to a new place and setting up housekeeping. Now, obviously, they're not coming to a new land by themselves. There's already Native American Indians living here. But for the most part, the Native American Indians and the Plymouth peoples had very little contact with each other for a long time. So you can see it as a founding population. That is, they're coming to a new place, they're on their own, they're setting up housekeeping, they're developing their own rules, and in that sense alone, it's very fascinating. The second part is the transgenerational data. And as John mentioned previously, first the epigenetics is crucial, the genetic information is crucial, but understanding families and human behavior it's really important that we have this transgenerational life history data. So it's not just one person's life history, that is from when they are born until they die, but their children and their grandchildren. So, for example, some of the papers that we're working on right now shows that one of the arguments that you have in the field is called the grandmother hypothesis. The argument is that the evolution of menopause, or what's the actual truth of that, is that you have a long post-reproductive lifespan with the females. The reason that might have come about is that related females live together. And so that the older female can turn off her own reproduction to help her children and her grandchildren survive, so that that would be an adaptation and that would spread, and you would see the evolution of menopause in a long post-reproductive lifespan. You need transgenerational data to look at that. the transgenerational data clearly show that the presence of maternal mothers helped the survivorship of grandchildren. So the data clearly show that if the daughter's mother is present, the children survive better. The grandmother is investing in the children. But the data also show that the children survive better when other people are around, other women are around. So for example, sisters-in-laws who aren't related at all to the children help increase child survivorship. And a study that we recently did with this database of the Plymouth colonies, and we have now four or five generations of it, we look at migration patterns, who moved at puberty, who married whom, where are they living, who are they living with. The interesting pattern that came out of that is the youngest children, the last born children, and sometimes these were the seventh, eighth, ninth born children, when they got married, they didn't even have their parents alive. And they lived in communities with brothers and sisters and brothers-in-laws and sisters-in-laws. The interesting thing is they didn't have their parents alive, and they had the highest reproductive success. They had the most children and the most surviving children. What does this mean? We're not sure yet, but it could possibly mean that as parents age, it's actually that the children are investing in the aging parents. And so it's taking time away from investing in their children to look after their aging parents, where if the parents are already gone, as in the case in every single one of our last born children got married with at least one of their parents dead. And they had high reproductive success, and they lived in communities with their brothers and sisters. So more of cooperative breeding and not... So we're not discounting the fact that grandmothers are important. They are. But it certainly isn't the only thing that's important for child survivorship.
Next, Dr. Heath explains why such detailed life histories are key to understanding who we are today.
So the transgenerational data not only will provide what seems like insignificant data. For example, your father was a smithy, or you had a large food crop that year when you were 12 years old going through puberty. At the same time, the transgenerational data can give us information about grand schemes in evolution, who we are as hominids. Both of it has huge implications for, one, epigenetics, which may last up to three generations, maybe longer. It's a new field, we don't know. Certainly has vast information on genetics. If families live together and they help each other out, those are going to be genes that passed on in the next generation. The others are not, at the expense of the others, small families, people who live alone. Maybe the opposite will show. So it will give us a lot of information on both the small scale and the large scale to help us better understand who we are, where we came from, where we're going.
That was Kathleen Heath, Associate Professor of Anthropology at Indiana State University. For Access Utah, I am Sherry Quinn. Stay tuned for Science Questions.
It was pretty noisy around here last week. There was a week-long fiesta in the downtown area with food, carnival rides, and music. Lots of music. Loud music that rolled up the hill over our balcony and into our little home. It was San Jose days here, and they put on a fiesta that was very much like the county fairs we were accustomed to in the States. Centro San Jose del Cabo was abuzz with turistas and locals alike strolling the midway. There were games, typical carny games. You could pick up a little pellet rifle and try your luck knocking off targets for a stuffed toy. You could try to stand up a pop bottle with a hook attached to the end of a fishing rod for prizes. You could stuff yourself on cotton candy. The only difference? Well, instead of hot dogs, you could gorge yourself on mega burritos, tacos, and a variety of delicious meats carved from spits taken straight from the grill. I think I might have spent a little too much for some burritos I bought, but that's okay, because a couple of nights before, I won more than I spent on the burritos at a craps table set up in the Carnival Zone. There are a lot of fiestas down here. We've celebrated Independence Day, Dia de los Muertos, Christmas, but this one, well, it fell in rather nicely, at least for us. You see, Karen and I came down here 3 years ago today as newlyweds. We stayed a week, and it was difficult to leave. Los Cabos had captured our hearts. It still holds us in its grip. It's a place where we walk hand in hand through Centro San Jose del Cabo sometimes on a warm evening, just two mingled souls enjoying each other's company. We've collected coconuts and mangoes on the roadside, eaten in some of the most incredible little backstreet taquerias you could ever imagine, and seen humbling sunsets and joyous sunrises. We have randomly picked up and gone to the beach to stare off into the vast ocean with no other purpose than to, well, stare off into the vast ocean and marvel at its power and beauty. We have met some very interesting people from all over the world who have enlightened us in so many ways, hung out with some of the locals who have warmed our hearts with their kindness. Most importantly, we found that certain peace we had both been searching for so desperately in a place where living life is defined in much different, more realistic, and personal terms. It's not always easy, but life's that way. As long as you keep it simple and realize the best you can do is live, laugh, and love, you'll be just fine. That's something Kara has taught me, and I love her for it. There's no place I'd rather be, and nobody I'd rather be here with. This is Ed Casilla for Utah Public Radio.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
My name is Brittany. I live in Washington City. I listen to UPR so I can stay up to date on pretty much everything here in Utah and all over the world. My favorite weekend program is Car Talk. I just love the click and clack, the Tappa Brothers. I donate to UPR to do my part in helping my favorite radio station stay on the air. My life is better with UPR.
Support for Science Questions comes from USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Science.
Questions. Radio.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Sherry Quinn. As the debate over embryonic stem cell research continues in this country, fueled by moral debates and the hope for miracle cures, scientists working with adult stem cells are picking up the pace of research and making progress. It's too early to tell whether these cells can slow down or reverse the aging process, but they may be able to mend a broken heart. The heart begins its countdown in the womb. It's simply a pump driven by tiny electrical impulses in each cell, beating in rhythm as it pushes blood through the body. The fetal heart starts out fast, then the rhythm slows into adulthood. By age 20, our bodies are losing millions of cells each year, so scientists are scouring every tissue of the body for fresh supplies. They're looking for adult stem cells that seem to hide in tissue reservoirs like bone marrow. When triggered by chemical signals of trauma, disease, or aging, these unspecialized cells can turn themselves into specialized cell types, like muscle, skin, and heart cells. Studies that extract stem cells from rodents and re-inject them into damaged heart tissue have shown the injected cells will specialize and make some repairs. There's evidence now it can happen also in human hearts. Scientists believe stem cells might respond to stimuli like a sudden decrease in oxygen when a cell dies, or the release of an enzyme in damaged muscle. When the siren of injury goes off, these paramedic cells rush to the scene of damage. Through adhesive molecules, they are able to graft onto injured tissue, mature into heart cells, and regenerate the tissue. The University of Utah in Salt Lake City is paving the way for the use of adult stem cells in the treatment of heart disease under the leadership of
Amit Patel, Director of Cardiovascular Regenerative Medicine at the University of Utah.
Since he was a young boy, Dr. Patel says he knew he wanted to become a cardiac surgeon.
The most fascinating thing about the heart is it's the most simple yet the most complex organ in the body, meaning that it's a pump. So, and most people are like, well, that's all it is. But yet it has hormones, it has other neurofunction, but it's something that is very tangible. It isn't, you know, like the pancreas or the liver where it has a lot of processing capabilities, it releases hormones. It's, those organs are much more complex than the heart. The heart has a lot of just physical parts that basically pump blood that's oxygenated throughout your body and the deoxygenated to your lungs. So it's one of the most important things, because if that wasn't working, all your other organs fail. Something like a kidney, you could live without a kidney. Can't live without a heart.
Cardiac surgery is his day job, he says. The rest of the time, he's conducting human clinical trials on adult stem cell therapy for the treatment of human diseases and leading research on the growth of human tissue and organs. He moved to Utah a year and a half ago.
There's a lot of great things here which most people don't realize. There's the great cell therapy facility, a lot of patients, and just the opportunity to do a lot of advanced therapies which really are not available in most parts of the country.
And why is that?
It's just the right people, the right environment, and just general enthusiasm in the university and the entire healthcare system to really do novel things for the patients here regionally, and also many patients that come from around the country now here.
Were you one of the first people to do these studies, human clinical trials?
Yes. I was one of the first people in the U.S. and around the world to actually do cell-based therapy for the heart. And for a lot of our newer trials, we truly are still pioneering. Every month we have new projects, new trials to help patients with different types of diseases. The cell is just one of the many things that we use. There's cells, there's small molecules, and tissue engineering. But our focus early on is cells, but now we're step by step, we go from cells to tissues to then organs that we'll build.
Right now, there are 40 patients in Dr. Patel's clinical trials where they are using adult stem cells from bone marrow to repair damaged heart tissue. If this therapy is successful, he says the U of U team's ultimate goal is to reproduce the treatment in centers around the world, so as many patients as possible will have the opportunity to benefit from the therapy.
Is it too early to tell any of the results?
The results are very promising in the sense that we don't have final data on any of them, but we definitely know the safety factor thus far, that the cells that we're putting into patients have not caused any irregular heartbeats or abnormal tissue growth or things that a lot of people were scared about in the early days. But we are seeing some very positive trends in terms of patients getting better. We're just trying to get better and better objective measures other than just the patient saying that they feel better, which is still very important. That's probably the most important thing. But can we make the therapies more reproducible to a wider patient population? And that's what a lot of the trials really can address, is a lot of things can work for individual patients, but how can we make a relatively simple and safe therapy that could be broadly applied to as many patients as possible?
Can you describe the process from...
Sure. For our patients who have heart failure, and meaning that their heart just does not have the ability anymore to pump enough blood and oxygen to supply the body's demands, we actually make a small incision just under their left chest, and we go in between the ribs and open up the sac around the heart and directly inject right into the muscle while the heart is still beating.
And how long of a process?
It takes about an hour.
And so you are extracting the stem cells from the patient's bone marrow?
In our current trial, we take 3 tablespoons of bone marrow and put them in a bioreactor. It's almost like an incubator, so we can grow up all the cells. So instead of 3 tablespoons, before we used to have to take almost 0.5 liter to 1 liter to get the same amount of cells that we need. Now we could take a lot smaller amount of bone marrow and just let the bioreactor expand it, which takes about 12 days. We have other trials up and coming where we actually can take the bone marrow and process it right at the bedside in 12 minutes and directly inject it back into their heart or their leg.
How are you able to take it immediately out of the bone marrow and right into the heart?
There's a number of small companies based right here in Utah that we work with that have little devices and machines that they've developed to separate out the bad part of the cells and actually concentrate the really good part.
And do it fast.
And do it very fast.
How will it separate them so quickly?
All of these cells have a different weight on them. So based on gravity and also filter size, you can separate out a lot of the impurities pretty quickly. So it's not as a pure population of cells as the culture technique, but it's a good mixture of cells.
Okay.
And that's part of some of the clinical work that we're doing, is seeing is a pure cell better than a mixed soup of cells as we normally have in our body. Because a lot of time the soup of cells, there's the important stem cell or progenitor cell in the middle of it, but there's all these other supporting cells that help nurture it and protect it from some of the bad environments that we have to put these cells into, where they don't have a lot of oxygen, blood supply, or nutrients.
How do you separate the stem cells from the regular animal?
That's a great question. So we actually do a number of things. There are different antibodies that we use to separate out the important cells from the weak cells, and also the environment or the soup that we grow the cells in actually are more prone to how do we actually make cells grow in the exact characteristic we want. So it's added, the different ingredients we add to the soup help determine, are these cells going to go towards making heart muscle or making nerves or making any other type of tissue that we want. And what happens is, as we culture these cells, the weaker cells die off, and the stronger ones are the ones that grow and expand.
Who are ideal candidates for cell therapy, I guess particularly the heart, and is there a certain point, age cutoff?
So that's a great thing, is when we use the bioreactor, there's no age cutoff, because part of the culture process accounts for age. So most people would think younger cells are better than older cells, but in a culture process, even older patients have young cells in them, and that's what the culture process is able to identify and just grow the younger cells. So we look at the entire spectrum of patients who have heart disease. So the patients who've just had a heart attack, to the ones who've had stents or bypass surgery, but they still have chest pain. So anyone who has chest pain after they've already had a stent or a bypass operation may be an early candidate for one of our cell-based therapies. And then pretty much majority of the patients who have heart failure, they all are potential candidates for cell-based therapy. So it's a pretty broad population of patients, and we have very specific criteria of who can fit into which trial.
After you inject the cells, how soon are you seeing any results?
Depending on what the specific reason of the cell therapy is, you can see it as early as 1 month, but most of them it's 3 to 6 months for heart diseases. And the peak effect you'll see almost at 1 year. It's not a magic pill that you'll see an effect within the next day, but there are some cell-based therapies for certain lung diseases that we do see effect within the first week.
Wow.
Just because the cells start working immediately and releasing certain molecules and other things that help improve function.
And what are risks involved in potential complications?
There are always risks with any type of therapy that's very new, that there's always the possibility, the most basic thing is it doesn't work at all. And that may not be uncommon early on, just because even drugs that are already approved, not the same drug doesn't work for everybody. And so it's always trying to find the right patient that may have the potential benefit. There's always things that we just don't know about because we haven't been doing this for 20 or 30 years, that there are other risks that may occur. And we always let patients know that majority of the cell-based therapies are still considered research. No matter how much people may think that, well, it's my body's own cells, how can that be research? It's because it is, because we're taking them from one part of your body, putting it into another, or taking them from one part, expanding them, and then putting them in. So there's always a component of research and risk, and that's why we're so grateful to these patients that they're willing to volunteer for these trials, because the potential is not only can it help them, but it'll help the next generation of patients who end up with these diseases.
Dr. Patel explains there are several different ways to make and utilize the adult stem cells for heart repair.
We actually have at least three different options. So we have where we could take them rapidly from their own bone marrow or blood, process them, and put them back into the patient. We have the ones where we take a small amount and culture them, or put them in this bioreactor for a week to 3 weeks. And then our third option, which is still in the early phases of patient trials, is actually getting cells that are completely off the shelf, that have no immune reaction. So you could actually take one person's cells and put them into someone else. And those trials are also ongoing for other diseases.
When would you decide if it's better to use off-the-shelf versus the patient's own cells?
Before all the science is done, the most basic thing would be if someone is coming in with a heart attack right now, they need all the oxygen-carrying capacity that's out there. So taking their bone marrow or blood would actually hurt them. So in that situation, the potential for an off-the-shelf cell to decrease the size of the heart attack or the scar tissue, that may be a realistic option. Other times maybe that their own cells don't have the quality that we need, and even the bioreactor can't help them. And that's why a younger off-the-shelf cell may be good for a lot of inflammatory disorders.
The research appears promising, but there are skeptics who caution not to get too excited yet.
We expect people to be naysayers and actually have a healthy bit of skepticism. That's completely reasonable. As when we do these trials, we still have to be skeptical of a lot of the positive things that we're seeing, just to make sure that it isn't a random event. But our true goal, for the most simple way to put this, is how do we take different components of the body and use them to heal itself? And can we add just other little molecules and other things to improve that process? Because the body has the ability to heal itself. The problem always is, can it do it in a manner that's as fast as we want it? And how do we get rid of some of the issues with scar tissue that prevent the natural healing process? So healing with scar is normal, but at some point it becomes pathologic. I think a lot of the controversy is more related to not knowing what we really do. So when most people realize and see what we do, it almost takes the fun out of the argument. They're like, okay, you're taking your own cells or off-the-shelf cells and you're putting them back into the body. Where's the controversy in that? The connotation for most people when they hear stem cells is they automatically think it's embryonic. And there's so many variety of cells out there. There's no one cell that is ideal for anything. It's the entire population of from embryonic to the induced pluripotent cells, where you can actually reprogram an adult cell to a more younger cell, and all the family of adult cells, whether it's from blood, bone marrow, fat. I mean, every organ in your body has stem cells.
Okay.
It's just a matter of how do we find those cells, reactivate them, and really get them going to get the body to function more efficiently as when patients were much younger.
Would you say they're rare?
They are very rare. And that's part of the problem, that as you get older, your body has fewer and fewer stem cells.
In fact, certain cells in the body can regrow and replace dead or dying cells. For about 100 years, it was generally accepted that brain cells were finite from birth, and the adult human brain could not grow new cells. Evidence is now continuing to reveal brain cells regenerate themselves. The heart is also continuing to surprise scientists.
The skin is about every 7 days, red blood cells about 120 days. So there are parts in your body that have a very high regenerative capacity. The heart, on the other hand, up until 5 years ago, no one even believed there were stem cells in the heart. No one could prove it. Now that they've been able to identify it, it's still controversial. And so people believe it's anywhere from 5 to 20 years for the entire cell population of the heart to turn over. So that's a very slow cell turnover, and that's what makes it so difficult when you look at cell or any biological or chemical therapies to heal the heart, just because it's such a slow-growing organ.
How long do they live, I guess, in the body?
No one knows. I mean, every cell has a certain rate of death, but no one has identified how to figure out what the clock is and how can you actually somehow put a probe in and say this cell has this time clock on it and then it's going to die. Mm. There are certain cues and markers that people have identified, but there's no magic way to tell when a stem cell is going to die.
And then how promising is it for reversing the aging process?
Well, I think that's a very important question, that most of these cell therapies in their ideal form actually slow down the aging process and in some cases reverse it to a certain degree. I don't think they can reverse it all the way back to totally when you were young, but it can definitely slow down the aging process. There are enough cells that have been identified not only just in the lab dish but circulating in patients that you can identify that why does this 80-year-old look younger than this 60-year-old and function better. And you could look at certain cell characteristics and things and you can identify why people look younger and function better than others.
Unregulated clinics are popping up around the world and illegally in the U.S. that specialize in selling cell therapy for anti-aging purposes. That's a problem, says Dr. Patel.
So that's always the scary thing about cell-based therapies, is because sometimes the easiest forms of cell therapy make them available to too many people who abuse them. So there are renegade clinics in the world where you can just go to a anti-aging spa and they will inject cells into you. Whether they're human, animal, or other things, there are clinics in most parts of the world that you can go to that will just inject anti-aging cells into you. There's no proof that they work. We don't know if it's just a placebo effect because the patients feel that they got cells. That's the biggest problem. I don't have problems with the clinics themselves or people wanting to travel around the world to get different therapies that are available or not available. The key to all of it is that everything needs to be validated in some sort of scientific form. That here was a group of patients who got salt water, here's a group that got cells, and this is what we found. And if they see positive effects, then I think they should run with that. I think that's very important. But until they do that, these are sort of just one patient testimonials, which makes it very scary for the common patient who doesn't have a scientific background. They'll see it's almost like an infomercial. Oh, look, this patient had this and they're walking again. Their heart's better. They regrew their hair. They look younger. But that may truly be an individual patient effect if it truly is real, and there's no guarantees that it may help this patient. So it's sort of playing a lot of patients' fear and just of, you know, I'm going to die or I'm going to have this problem, and they're willing to try anything. And that's what the fine line of a lot of these clinics we worry about, where they don't have any scientific data to support the things that they do.
Are these mostly outside of the U.S.? Are there any in the U.S.?
There are some in the U.S., but most of them are outside. Most of them are outside, and they're everywhere from Central America, South America, Europe, Asia. They're everywhere.
So the ones here inside the U.S. are in the U.S., do they just have to make it clear that it's not FDA approved and they're able to do it legally?
Well, I don't think there's any that are legal.
So why use adult stem cells when their potential to turn into other cells is limited? Embryonic stem cells are what's called pluripotent stem cells. These stem cells have the potential to produce almost any type of cell in the body. They are mainly available in embryos and in umbilical cord blood. Researchers have isolated these pluripotent cells from human embryos that consist of 50 to 150 cells. Potentially, researchers could keep these pluripotent cells dividing, then trigger new cells into turning into all different types of adult human cells. Next, Dr. Patel explains why adult stem cells are preferred for use in cell therapy.
It's never a matter of is one cell better than the other. It's just that adult cells are more clinically ready to be put into patients right now based on the early safety records and also some of the early benefits. The embryonic stem cells are great at figuring out a lot of the mechanisms of how the cells work, how do you develop them, and how you may be able to improve therapy. So there may be a role for them down the road, but right now it's purely a scientific as opposed to treating real patients.
I get deeper into this thing. The deeper I go, the more knowledge I know what to sing, what to bring.
In conclusion, Dr. Patel explains what makes our hearts so sensitive and the factors that hurt it the most as we age.
Heart disease, as you may know, is the number one killer of most adults. And the causes are something as the basic thing of high blood pressure that's not managed well, all the way to heart failure, or where the blood vessels actually fall apart from long-term high blood pressure. And so it's the diseases of the blood vessel and the lining of the blood vessels. So this can be everything from smoking to high cholesterol, where the plaques actually damage the vessels and they become harder and harder, or they get more and more scar tissue and plaque and they actually get blocked. So those are the most common forms that we see in patients.
Is that related then to diet, lifestyle, basically?
Diet and lifestyle have a very important and significant impact in that. So a lot of people would like to blame their genetics unto itself, and the genetics play a certain role, but it's the environmental factors that are over and above the genetics which really play a larger impact as you get older.
That was Dr. Amit Patel, Director of Cardiovascular Regenerative Medicine at the University of Utah.
Father hope and father pain, and the light, they both look the same. Put them out on.
In our final segment, we continue our series, Highlighting Science in the Classroom, recognizing that an interest in science is something that develops over a lifetime and starts early. Wasatch Elementary third grade students researched anything that was in outer space and then wrote a postcard about it to someone on Earth.
Hi, my name is Peyton and I'm 8, and I'm writing from Mercury. Hi, Lily. I don't know if you've noticed, but I've been gone for a very long time because I'm 48 million miles away. Just to let you know, I'm on Mercury. Mercury rotates around the sun every 59 days. And I'm moving around the sun faster than any other planet. See you in half a year, Peyton Ledbetter.
Okay.
My name is Robert, and I am 9 years old, and I'm reporting on Neptune. Hi, Mom. The reason you found me making that rocket in the backyard, well, I went to the 8th planet from the sun, Neptune. You know, if I weighed 8 more pounds, where I'd be at 70 pounds, I would be 10 more pounds. And I'm almost falling through this place. It's gas. See ya. Love, Robert.
And that's a wrap. Thanks for listening. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. For more information, visit sqradio.org.
Science Questions is made possible by a U.S. Department of Labor grant from the Utah Governor's Office of Economic Development and the Utah Department of Workforce Services. We'll be right back.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from the USU Center for Women and Gender, hosting Center Stage, music honoring Women's History Month. It's this Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. in the USU Performance Hall. Information is at arts.usu.edu.
Hi, this is Steve McIntyre from Beaver Dam, Arizona. Quite some distance from the UPR studios, but the signal reaches me loud and clear. It was just a few years ago that I moved from the bright lights of the Upper West Side of Manhattan to a small, out-of-the-way Arizona town, so it's especially important to me to remain connected to the world at large, and there's no better connection than UPR. So you can see why my life is better with Utah Public Radio. As a New Yorker might say, it's not for nothing that I'm a proud member and listener.